Welcome again to Back to the Fucture, the podcast that chats to the innovators of today, who, of course, are making the future happen. And making the future happen with me this week is Quinning founder and creative director, Ian Johnston. Ian, many thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Martin.
Just one of the things that I have had huge conversations with people over the past week is this change in what they're calling the experience economy 4.0. Now, I know that you and I probably remember 2.0 and 3.0, but they're saying, look, post-COVID, everybody is talking about experience stores, experience moments, the notion of even the experiential customer. And I know from chatting to you previously, this is something that you have been focused on for quite a long time. So I just wanted to capture your thoughts about how you think this definition and journey of the experience economy has changed over the past decade.
Obviously, experience is really important for us. We're a design studio that creates different experiences for brands to help engage with their customers, right? And so it's really been at the core of everything we do for the last 20 years. We haven't always talked about it in that way. And it's fairly new, as you know, to have CEOs coming to you and saying, hey, we want our retail to be more experiential, right? And they seem to throw that word around pretty easily. The problem that we've always had is people don't really dive a little deeper. You know, experiences is a top level word to describe everything. What is it? Is it the look and feel? Is it the operations? Is it the services I see in store? And so we use a framework here at Quinning, which really just tries to help structure the conversation, help bring consistent language so I can talk about experiences with different stakeholders across a business, right? And so really that word experience scares me in a lot of ways because it doesn't have a lot of meaning to it. And so we try to dive a little deeper, right? We talk about the functional experience, the social experience, the educational experience, the entertainment experience. And Martin, if you can get all of those at a place that's really delightful, you create what we call the escapist experience. Now, you made reference to The Experience Economy, which is a book that I read, you know, probably 20 years ago.
Pioneer. 1996, I think. When
oh my
it
God.
Came out originally, make, yes. I'm not saying old. That's when you were around. Like, you could have bought a reissue or the seventh edition, but I'm sure it was actually as far back as 1996.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really underpinned our thinking with regards to experience, right? It talked about the need for social experiences and educational and entertainment, even escapist in many ways, right? And certainly within retail, those all arrive in different levels. The one thing it doesn't talk about is the sort of functional experience, right? If you think about it, most brand engagements are basis, you know, around a functional type of experience. We land ourselves pre-pandemic and even post-pandemic around, you know, frictionless, convenient stories, right? This seems to be a topic which is driving, you know, how brands appear on the high street or how people engage with brands. It's a very functional aspect to it. And that's important, right?
Exactly. I guess now, if I think about online, people want seamless. They want, you know, Uber functionality. They want the sense of things being absolutely clear to the point of not requiring you to think about it. So I have that on one side. And then you've got, if I go back to the high street, is that what I'm also looking for? Or when I say I want experience, is this a different kind of experience now to what it was 10 years ago? Because a lot of the time I'm thinking about, and you will have this experience, to use that word, the CEO will say to you, you know, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. But as soon as the economy settles down, it's almost like they revert back to the big white box again. Do you think that is the case? Or do you think this version of experience economy around, they really are making decisions to make things different?
Well, what's really interesting there, Martin, if we had had this conversation 6 months ago, you know, when we were really emerging out of the pandemic, at that moment, you know, a new type of experience where we engage consumers on different levels, social, educational, entertainment, that was very much the focus for many brands, right? It really seemed to be that the pandemic tip the appetite towards those expectations of the consumer. We were working on many projects that took that flavor and started to see how that would appear in store. But as we emerged out of that, and I think this is the really important bit, you know, over the last 10 years, the accelerated pace that we've now experienced is so quick, right? And so even though coming out of the pandemic, we were talking about experiential retail, quotation marks, we very quickly pivoted towards the impact of the struggle in the economies, the wage demands, inflation, energy prices, and et cetera. And so in some ways, we weren't able to deliver some of those experiential moments in the store because the appetite of the consumer switched so quickly to be value and price driven, right? And so I reckon there was thousands of brilliant ideas all over the world left on the table as brands shifted very, very quickly, right? Like this happened in the space of 3-4 months where there was budgets to push a new type of experience in retail. Yet we came back very, very quickly, you know, and everything became around price and value.
I agree with you. And I think about how that has happened in retail. But then I look at, for example, hospitality, and I look at travel, and I look at those industries where, given there has been a massive cut in consumer spend, I would expect them to go back to value and to essentials. And yet, I am still seeing fantastic restaurants open, really scarily beautiful hotels, experiences being engineered by companies like Black Tomato, for example, where it really is about immersing me. And I'm just worried that retail forever panics without committing to the long journey. They opt for the quick, short solution, which invariably is this white box. And my kind of argument against doing that is that everybody does that. So the only way potentially you can stand out is through remarkable and brilliant experiences. And what's lacking, I don't think, is consumer desire or money, to be honest with you, with a lot of those retailers. I think it's imagination, a failure of imagination on behalf of a lot of the CEOs who are trying to protect their pensions and their short-term shareholder value and not really think about the customer who, if all things are equal, will just buy the stuff online anyway. So they're not even going to the store. So in some ways, the stores are becoming redundant unless we commit to this new way of defining experience. Or is that just me ranting and being Irish? And
I'm with you 100% there, Martin. And I would even suggest being brave, putting your mark in the sand a little bit, right? There's not as much of that as I would have hoped. We always talk about people doing a good job rather than saving their job, right? Like, let's push the boat out there, right? But I want to add another aspect to that where a lot of designers, you know, we land on this idea of experiential retail. And, you know, we think it's these social experiences and events in store and this hospitality that comes into place. And I think that that is true. Those elements come into effect. But the basis of retail, which has been around for hundreds of years, of discovering things on the shop floor and purchasing them, those aspects of retail are still intertwined into this new kind of experiential retail. It's not that we're just taking that transactional component and throwing it online. This mix of having the functional plus all these other elements is a way of integrating them at a slower pace that matches the business needs, right? Because, you know, you think about the customer needs, great, that's really important. Staff needs are just as important. We have the business needs and the brand needs. And physical retail especially is so demanding. It needs to work on multiple fronts, right? And so there is rent to pay, right? So at some point, there has to be some kind of transactions. And until we can really create that operational omni-channel that we've been promising people, where the back end talks to each other, and we're getting very close to that, Martin, I do believe, where a sale can start in store and finish online, and the business sees that as one type of customer journey or customer engagement rather than three different ones.
So either we're competing with Uber convenience in the store and simple products, et cetera, or the store really does become something so radical and different that when I set out, I'm not going for convenience, I'm not going for value, I'm not going for my essentials. I really am going to spend time in a place that's really giving me experiences that I I guess I become wedded to the brand, and I will then go online and buy this stuff and have it delivered to my house without the struggle and the embarrassment of having to carry it back in a bus or a tube or equivalent.
I hear you there, Martin. You know, a lot of it is a gap, a sort of opportunity coming out of COVID. Certainly wasn't taken up by enough retailers, right? And even during the COVID experience we had, I don't think we did enough to change. And I definitely think, you know, we all sat around in the retail world thinking, right? This was an amazing moment. Everything stopped. We had a moment to think about carving the future that we wanted to have, that potentially we could deliver to our customers and our staff. And that didn't really materialize in that way.
Which I guess is why they need people like you and people like me. But I also fear that we're a bit like kind of ancient old gnarly prophets screaming in the desert, and where people pay us to entertain them when it suits them. But actually, nobody ever commits to a better way of doing something. They wait for somebody to do it. This is my great annoyance, is they wait to see it. And then they say, we want it to look like X store or Y store. But what they do is they don't make it look better. They dilute it down because of their fear of producing something that maybe they don't understand. And as I always point out to retailers, you know, it's you never find a bored customer. You find a customer that's fed up with a particular store, but customers are always looking for new, next, different challenges. And yet retailers are failing so much to do that for them.
100%. It's interesting you say that, Martin. And I think in many ways, if we are brave enough to walk with our consumers and take them on a journey, and we're very open and honest that we're on a journey together. I mean, look at the way Apple has transformed itself into an educational institution on the high street. That didn't happen overnight. They went through a number of iterations so that they walked their consumer, their customer with them to where they are today, where really it's an educational institution with a gift shop attached to it. And they flipped the whole thing to arrive there. They didn't look at what was out there. They looked at what was possible. What do my customers want? What do my customers expect? Let's push beyond that in some ways. And so there are examples of people pushing, certainly not enough. Too many copycats out there. I don't know how many stores resemble the Apple store to a T in so many ways. And it's such a frustrating experience for me, Martin. There's so much opportunity to stand out.
I mean, it's interesting. You know, I'm a great lover of department stores, because I always think, you know, if you think about Selfridges or you think about Printemps or you visit in New York, you know, even places like the old Barneys, not necessarily the ones that have kind of been left over, but they really understood that sense of all per square foot. So they weren't trying to corral you into buying necessarily. They were trying to show you things in a beautiful context, a fantastic setting. They were setting your expectations. So you really felt you wanted to participate, you know, in that brand and in that moment. To go back to your point about the Apple stores, if you visit the one in Rome, which I think you've written about, how it's so like stepping inside a cathedral or stepping inside a great forest or a beautiful glade. And you really then want to participate in the brand. If you had to rework for a fictional client, what is it that you would do to say, this is going to really change A, the store, and B, activate what I'm going to call that, you know, all per square foot moment? That's my challenge to you.
Wow. Okay. How long do we have here? We know that sales per square foot as a metric no longer exists. We know the awe-inspired experience that you're talking about, for me, leans into surprise and delight. Now, you're combining surprise and delight with the look and feel of a store, and sometimes they're connected and other times they're not. The architecture of a store is almost one of your first experiences with someone, and it sets the tone for what happens afterwards. We've done a little bit of work on how the quality of the look and feel, the materials and the experiences we have, and how the products that you place in there or the brand you place in there, and how you can use amazing finishes of a luxury store, yet you're selling an economy brand, and how that creates this gap where the experience exceeds the expectations of the brand. And that leads to this thing we call the value gap, right? It's like finding a fiver on the road or getting more value than I pay for. And so we can design that into our experiences, into our stores in many ways. And those are the kinds of feelings that resonate and build trust and build loyalty over the long term. But once that initial feeling of the look and feel, the awe-inspired metric, you know, subsides, I come in the second time. I want more from that experience. And so where we find ourselves in this moment is that, you know, that architectural moment is a fantastic starting point. It might attract people into the store to begin with, but unless you continue to deliver surprising and delightful experiences on an ongoing basis, like you said, I get bored of the store.
It's fascinating because I think once you commit to what I'm going to call issues-based retail or experiential retail, you are committing to a program or committing to multiple experiences or an ongoing narrative. And I think that's probably the big issue where everybody sets out with the great gesture building. You know, I'm thinking of, for example, the Samaritaine in Paris, you know, the new DFS. It is such a beautiful, splendid experience, an emporium that celebrates both heritage and potential legacy. And yet, they have designed the interior to feel like a duty-free concourse in a large anonymous airport. So after my first visit, I felt, well, there is no reason for coming back and no reason for even discussing experience, which is what they keep telling you when you talk about the store to the architects. However, and just as a kind of a codicil to that, you know, I think about when I was chatting to the creative director at Selfridges, she said, when we're thinking about a year, we're like a newspaper, we're thinking about headlines, we're thinking about issues, we're thinking about stories. And as a consequence, when you go to that store, it is brimming, isn't it? Brimming totally. With people compared to Le Samaritaine, where I think if I kicked a football through the main aisle, I'd possibly hit an assistant if I was lucky, but certainly wasn't going to hit another customer.
We are always trying to build in opportunities to drive footfall back into store. What are the reasons you come back into store? You know, one of the big things we're building on right now, Martin, is how we want to use online to drive customers in store, and we want to use in store to drive customers back online. And so they work in tandem together. And in doing that, you can really start to use the store in unique ways. Digital is a great opportunity if we do it right. Too many brands take their online assets and use them in store. Well, how ridiculous is that? Am I really going to sit there and watch a movie I can watch on YouTube for 10 minutes? The real opportunity is to take digital and physical, combine them together to create unique, customizable, personalized experiences that are unique and specific to that location.
One of the things I find quite extraordinary is, given the amount of evidence-based research coming through from neuroscientists, you know, I know you mentioned this quite a lot in your blogs, if you think about the shift in what we're calling neuroarts and neuroaesthetics, we know that certain colors, certain tactilities, certain placing will trigger endorphins, oxytocin, dopamine. So there's a physical reaction to seeing, touching, smelling, and still we have the CEOs questioning and challenging what I call the proofs of beauty. You know, they go, well, I get that, but actually, how do I know? And I'm going, but look, this is the science behind it. So it has to carry with it some commitment at some time where people say, look, online will do certain parts of the journey well, and it pushes us to the next part, which is the IRL bit or equivalent. And then that extends our relationship and increases potentially awe. And what that awe is doing is making us more desirable of the things which we are seeing online and the things that we see in the store. So it's giving us a better dance with the brand to the view of developing a greater relationship with it. And I still puzzle as to why a lot of retailers don't look to the signs, which is what they always tell me. We need facts. We need evidence. It's there. Why aren't you believing it? Why aren't you believing that beauty in itself is a hugely powerful tool to drive value and to drive profits? There's no dispute about it.
It's really interesting, Martin. It's something that's fascinated me for a while in many ways. Where we are today, and it's an evolving part of science, I guess, in the way we understand our brain and how it's impacted, you know, certainly by space in some ways, right? One of the challenges we have is a lot of that research is done in a lab, right? And so it's very difficult to set up a real life situation where I get real life responses, where I can monitor someone's neural network and understand how they're responding to things in the real. Still, it's still quite theoretical. But nonetheless, I mean, we use it in this way. And to be fair, Martin, not everyone is going to be able to afford that kind of research in their own stores, right? Because it's a heavy program to do something like that. I don't even know how you would do that. But we always use it in multiple ways. And I'll come back to some of the techniques we use. But in many ways, just the fact that we now have data and science proving that space can impact your emotions, however you want to see that. If that's a chemical release of dopamines or what have you, we know there is a direct correlation to what I can do or what I can make to how you feel. And so that for us underpins a broader conversation we're having with CEOs and senior leaders, because the tools we now have, one of them specifically being, you know, VR, right? Yep. It is an amazing way to put that CEO into the space, get them to feel that way, right? And so the science helps to reinforce the feeling that they already have. And so even if they can't quantify the feeling, they have the feeling and they're like, oh my God, what was that? And so it starts to take the mystery out of design. The problem with design as a discipline is people think it's the dark arts. We see it in a such a different way. We don't try to convince people that this is the right design. We use design thinking and the process to help them see the right solution. And it's very much a deep thinking process that we walk them through. And so we want to demystify design.
Do you think it's where, you know, you have in a, I was thinking the C-suite or whatever, you've got the CFO, you've got the CTO, you've got the CEO, and nobody dares challenge them. But as soon as somebody who's the chief creative officer opens their mouth, they all have an opinion about it. I go, it's because we still believe it's all about adjective and not about the fact. And the reason I always bring this science into it, you know, I spent the last week chatting to Ivy Ross, who's the, you know, vice president of hardware at Google, and a colleague, not in Google, but a woman who works with her, who's a neuroscientist, Susan Seigsman. They've both written this book, which shows you the proofs, the evidences. It brings forward the simulations, the builds. So all things being equal, if you're a fairly intelligent and clever and keen CEO to really move the debate on about experience and about how the customer is engaging with these things, there is enough, I guess, empirical evidence there. What I kind of find extraordinary is, and I'm going to put this to you as well, every CEO I meet at the moment is talking about the metaverse and how they want to play the metaverse. And my view is, if you can't get in real life right, what hope have you of getting things right in the metaverse? Why are you even talking about this? And I go to your store and it looks like it's a post-apocalyptic warehouse. And you are now telling me that you're ready, willing, and able to jump into the metaverse. I mean, what do you say when you get CEOs telling you, Ian, I really want to get my brand into the metaverse?
Well, I mean, I'm probably like you, Martin. That big sigh probably tells the whole story. It's a nice opportunity to explore what a virtual reality might be. But we are very far away from integrating the metaverse and the real verse. Like you said, you know, get your ducks in a row first, right? Figure out physical retail and how digital can appear there in a positive way that adds meaning and value, that builds loyalty and trust. It's funny, we were talking about this earlier today, how retail's a pretty powerful opportunity for social change. I think it can do way more in that pathway than it's doing at the moment. And so retail is an opportunity to help change people's behavior so they can use physical and digital together. We can't just throw this metaverse on them and expect them people to live in that world. Maybe my 14-year-old son, who spends half his life in NBA 2K, will do that. But the rest of us won't, because our behavior and habits aren't like that. And so we need to transition slowly. The real opportunity is how, if the digital can create unique and customized experiences on top of the physical, where they're merged together, I'm still holding real objects, right? This idea of haptics and how I get that touch and feel from the metaverse, you know, fine, sitting in my living room, that might be possible, but we all know from the COVID experience that going out into the real world is very beneficial to all of us. And so do we really want to create a world where no one leaves their homes? And now, that said, Martin, I think there's a huge opportunity to create branded experiences in the home. We have a white van throwing boxes on our door where we have the opportunity to expand that into the home. I've just had a meal thrown on the door. Why isn't the guy coming in my house and showing a bit of hospitality? If it was a delivery car driver, he's explaining to me what sauces go with what meal. I think we've missed the opportunity to expand the delivery driver into a brand experience at home.
Yeah, I agree, because if you think about it, I think Net-a-Porter managed that with the two doorstep delivery. I think Waitrose at one point had started where, depending on your order and the amounts you ordered, they were happy to stack it into the fridge for you. You know, they were happy to bring it in. But I agree with you that while, yes, we are debating the cost of living crisis, it won't last forever. Like all of these things, it will change. The second thing is people's expectations, despite the cost of living, have become greater because of COVID. So if I'd suggested your idea to people 3 or 4 years ago, they would instantly put in the way of it all of the potential challenges, logistical issues, problematic issues of stranger danger in the home, where now they will be looking at how they could solve that challenge. Yeah. And I would put a bet on that as we're talking out there listening, there are quite a lot of Gen Z entrepreneurs and people on crowdfunding who are coming up with exactly that offer and solution. Because if I think about how our offices have started looking like our homes because of the whole hybrid work situation and our desire to create more social environments, our homes have started looking a bit like hybrid offices with that additional intrusion of people who we wouldn't normally have in our home. So it's already beginning to merge in a way that potentially this idea you've come up with could be a really good successful solution to entertainment.
Absolutely. I mean, push this a little further out. And I mean, there's two aspects here where the home becomes a little bit more like retail. Follow me for a second. It's probably beyond plausible and already happening where retail staff work from home. I work from the store 3 days of the week, and I work from home 2 of the other days of the week, doing different kinds of sales and doing different kinds of education and cross-selling and upselling and after-selling, those kinds of things, right? And so the home office for a knowledge worker could be the home office as a retail proposition. I have a rack of clothes there. And so why can't retail expand into the home in that way?
But I also think where previously there were a lot of resistances with both the customer and the retailer. Now the customer is better understanding of, you know, the whole principle of leasing, fractional ownership, in-home drinks products where they replenish the bar. You know, we're used to subscription models where
totally
monthly things are topped up and updated. So I really think we're at the point where you could potentially reframe retail. But my question is it an idea that will never take off because we're dealing with the same old brands who are incremental changers? Or is it just that practically we need logistics behind it and those kind of things can't be done in the scale or on the scale that you and I are perhaps thinking about? Or is that just me putting up a resistance to a good idea?
I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned there before, you know, I sit in meetings and hear people tell me why we cannot do something. Because that's what they know. We can't do it for this reason. Logistics, staff, whatever. We need more people to turn around and say, we're going to do it in spite of that.
Yes,
you know, all of those challenges we can overcome. And we've overcome them in the past. People don't like change. And so we need people to say, yes, there is all these barriers. But the potential to lose our customer to someone else is a far greater worry than the incremental steps that I need to deliver this thing in store. We also need a kind of appetite to say it doesn't need to be perfect, right? I said before, this transparency, this relationship with the customer that I can then develop, which we go on this journey together. That's why all these, you know, Gen Z and Gen A brands are going to be great, because they're starting to tell their story before the brand even starts. Like, I had this idea, and they start to get followers, and those followers become part of that journey. And that is powerful, right? Where they feel the brand's success is part of their success. They're intertwined and connected beyond what we have today, beyond the love mark kind of notion that we have today.
And I guess even the descriptors they use and increasingly we use, you know, we talk about an audience, you know, we talk about citizens. I noticed you use the term citizens. Very few people use the word customer now in the way that we previously defined customer, because it was such a subjective, such a lowly thing to be. And you were beholden to so many other things that the brand controlled. For now, with the whole issue of sustainability, with purpose, with our demands that brands be better citizen, they are entering a different kind of ecosystem. So just as a final thought, I want you to take the term you've used, citizen, and how I would see these kind of audiences, and now move it along 3 or 5 years hence. What do you see this new citizen partner looking, behaving, being like when they encounter brands? Are they people who are buying into them? Or are they people who are part of them? Or are they people who are having ongoing conversations where the brand is a friend, or is the brand still held at arm's length? Because maybe we don't want brands to be friends. We just want them to be good transactional entities.
Okay. So I'm glad you said 2 or 3 years out, because we think of that kind of as tomorrow. 10 years out is beyond tomorrow. And that's a whole different world, I think, when we get that far out. But 2 to 3 years down the road, I believe in many ways, you know, the failings of the institutions we have in place now, the religious institutions, the government institutions that used to provide meaning and value to people in society, people aren't engaging with them the way they used to. And I think brands are going to step into that vacuum that's left. But in order to do that, we need to kind of evolve the conversation so that, one, we listen more. It is not just a one-way broadcast. It's a two-way conversation. And I think we're already starting to see the start of that as we go. Social media has enabled that to happen. And so as we go to a kind of conversation, there needs to be more transparency involved in that. You talked about friends. We talked about reclassifying sales executives as friend makers in store, right? That's their job. Be friendly, be hospitable, and talk to people in store and make sure they know we want to be your friends. Now, as we transition towards that relationship, I think one of the powerful parts of retail that is only just starting to emerge is how a brand sells its virtues and its values. A recent statistic I read was something like 72 or 70% of Gen Z won't purchase anything from a company that doesn't align to their values. And so how do we represent that in store? If you think about it, we have the classic product categorization. But as products become the same, you know, we talked about what differentiates things. And so as we start to understand how brands can have social impact and change people's attitudes and behaviors and bring things that are important to them into the limelight. And so where we see we would only purchase the products before, we're very much going to purchase the brand as a holistic kind of entity because it underpins the values and virtues that we stand for. And so as the shop floor changes, we're going to see more of these initiatives presented on the shop floor involving the consumers. That's a big part of that conversation, right? We can't just tell them anymore. We've gone past just showing them. It's really important to involve them. As soon as we involve our customers, and I use that word in quotations because I would say citizens or friends or family, as soon as we involve them in an activity or an event, they really start to understand and connect and align themselves to what we're trying to achieve. And so I see a time where, you know, I'm a big Nike fan. And so in many ways, there will be an opportunity in the future that I get to vote on who the CEO is, on the actions and steps that my brand takes, the superstars that it wants to align with. I will have a say in that. It's no longer a member app. It's a citizen app. Why don't they turn their store into a polling station where they're actually asking their consumer, their citizens, on who should manage the board and drive this company into the future? And if you think about it, that's a really powerful place to be, where there's this interconnectivity between the staff, the people who work at headquarters, and the consumers. And they're all playing off each other, driving that brand into the place where it has, you know, such a positive impact and have a positive...
I'm going to call it decentralized, autonomous stakeholder organizations. There, I've given you a title.
My God.
Sadly, we have run out of time. I know it always seems to go really
quickly.
We
could talk forever, Martin.
We will do again, because I'm going to come back to you in 3 years' time to find out how well our citizens are doing. But in the interim, people can read more about your thoughts and see your work at www.quinninedesign.com.
Perfect.
I'm Martin Raymond. You've been listening to Back to the Future. Until the next time, can I ask you all to keep listening, keep looking, keep learning, and keep asking what's new and what's next?